Succession number 27755, Reel 5.
The interesting part about that prang was that the Court of Inquiry discovered that the reason for the failure of our engine was the fact that one of the small rubber connectors in the fuel line, one of the Jubilee clips on it had not been tightened properly, and it had gradually worked loose, which made us lose fuel supply to the engine. Now, all the time that I was wobbling, I was pumping high octane petrol all over an engine that was red hot. So we were lucky in a number of instances in getting away from that without any more serious injury. Then it wasn't long after that, I had been flying with Test and Dispatch Flight, which was a unit 320 MU on the drum, because their job, they reassemble aircraft that were shipped over, and then Test and Dispatch Flight had to carry out full flying tests and operations on it to make them operationally proficient for wherever they were going, up in Burma and that, you know. They knew I was a gunner, so whenever they got aircraft that had turrets on, I used to go across and test the turrets and that for them. But later on, after my pilot left me, I thought he was going home, but I later learnt that he went off to join a mosquito squadron. But after he left me, I was posted internally to this Test and Dispatch Flight, and that is where I finished my my operational tour, actually, and overseas tour. But that was quite interesting, because we used to have to carry out all the tests on the thing, and it was there that I suffered my fifth and final prank. We had a commitment to bow fighters, which had to go on a long sea leg to join their final destination point. So we fitted a 90-gallon tank in the fuselage, as well as a 90-gallon tank in its usual position on the underside. That's a tank that could be jettisoned once it was used, you know. Now, we were carrying out the final test on this particular bow fighter, and we had a maximum load, less about, I think there was only about 60 gallon in the drop tank that day, but we were on a maximum load. And also, we were taking off on our short runway, which was only 1,300 yards long because of the direction of the wind. And that runway ended at a ravine that was 30 foot across and about 20 foot deep. And that was backed by the main Karachi railway line, the embankment of which was 20 foot above the level of our runway. And it was flanked by telegraph poles with more wires on it than I have ever seen. The crossbars were down to within about a yard of the ground. That's how many crossbars there were on it. Right. We started off and we got to the point of no return on the runway. That is to say, there was no way you could stop. You had to go. And suddenly this vibration set up in the aircraft, and it was, oh, it's so terrible, it frightened me to death. I thought the aircraft was going to fall to pieces. But anyway, we got off the ground, but what had happened was the port engine had gone on us. So we got off the ground and we were in a slightly port wing down attitude. And I swear to this day that the tip of that wing only missed those wires by about 6 inches. If it had touched them, then I wouldn't be talking to you now, that's for certain. Anyway, Frank Glenn, who was flying the aircraft, came over the intercom and said, "We're in trouble, Les." I said, I'm right behind you, Frank. And of course I was right behind him, that was my position. But he told me after we landed, it reassured him, you know, it gave him a little bit of boost at that stage. But anyway, he got it off the ground, and I can only thank the power of the engines on the Bowfighter for that, getting us off the ground with all that weight on, you know. And then he was able to feather the port prop, which stopped all the vibration. And from there on in, it was just routine, really. The fact that we were port down turned us out over the desert. He jettisoned the drop tank, and that got rid of some weight anyway. And he'd already buzzed the tower to let them know we were in trouble. We're going to make a crosswind landing on the field. And we did. We came right round and made a call. He came in. We were a bit too high, actually, on the approach, but there was obviously no way we could go round again. So we did get down without any injury at all. And funnily enough, one of a rather interesting incident about that was I was wearing my normal crew parachute rig. That is just the harness. And the pack is stowed in a package nearby and has to be clipped on in a case of emergency. And when I made to get out of the aircraft, I found that my parachute pack was on. And to this day, I have not the slightest recollection of picking it out of that thing and putting it on, which says a lot for the emergency drills, which we always moaned about when we had to do. And I never moaned about emergency drills after that at all.
I was just going to ask you, what were emergency drills and what procedures did you have to do?
Emergency drills were doing that simple thing, simulating a condition where you had to use the parachute, and you unclipped it from the pack, you know, and clipped it onto the big hooks that were in front of you. Yeah, the actual suspension of the chute was just clipped down to about there so that you could ram it onto the hooks, you know.
In the middle of your chest.
Yeah, so the pack is now here in front of you. The only snag with that is I'm glad I didn't ever have to use it, because you could break your neck on this thing. If you screamed whilst you were facing downwards, this pack has to go up over your head, you know. And as a matter of interest, when I did the drill in the hangar at Yatesbury, was it Yatesbury? Yes, it was at Yatesbury. No, it must have been. I can't remember where it was, but they had a Blenheim jacked up above a catch net, and you had to go out through your emergency hatch. You had to practice going out.
The emergency hatch
was, mine was on the floor just forward of my turret position, and it was used as a camera hatch as well when they used to use camera. And you had to put your pack on, cross your arms across the pack, and crouch right down on your knees and just roll forward through the hatch. Now I did this, and I landed on the catch net on the back, you know, and this damn pack came up and split my top lip open.
So that was practicing?
That was just practice, yeah. We were never allowed to. I asked why we weren't allowed to do an actual drop, and the instructor said, "We've lost so many chaps doing the practice drop, we've stopped doing it." He said, you'll go out all right when there's an emergency. He said, don't worry about that.
Could you tell me from your logbook when that fifth prang occurred? Was that Bowfighter?
Bowfighter, yeah. That was the Bowfighter. That was number five, the last one. 8245. 8245, Bowfighter RV 298, pilot flying officer Glenn. Flow test, port engine cut on takeoff, jettison drop tank, feathered prop, climbed to 1,000 feet and made a single engine downwind landing, a really fine effort on the pilot's part, no injuries.
February 1945.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Where were you based at that time, sorry?
At Drigg Road, same base as the Indian Air Force unit. There was an internal posting to this unit. Where have we got to? It's gone too far. Right, I was with that unit up until yeah, 13-12-45. Last flight I did there was with Flight Lieutenant Hames in a Harvard 2B. And then came my posting home for demobilization. And we flew in a Liberator on the 23rd, 23-2-46. Moripur to Shaiba, Shaiba to Lida. Lida we stayed overnight, I know, because you had to stay there for 48 hours, acclimatization, that is to get your blood thickened up a bit more before you got back to Blighty, you know, because it was cold in Blighty. 25-2-46, Lida Cairo West, Benghazi Castle Bonito. Castle Bonito we stayed overnight again. 26-2-46, Castel Bonito, Tunis, Sardinia, Istres, and Bordeaux. We were diverted to Bordeaux because of bad weather. That was an overnight stay that was not scheduled. It was brought about by bad weather conditions. Following day, 27-2, we flew from Bordeaux, overflew Bournemouth to Oakington in Cambridgeshire.
Can you recall when the war in Europe finished? You'd obviously be still out there.
Yep.
Can you recall what happened when you heard about the news of the war in Europe?
Well, everybody was overjoyed at that, and we still had a job to do because the Far Eastern War was still in progress, you know. So our work didn't stop at all. We all celebrated. At the time, you know, probably had a jug up in the mess, I expect, should think, what would happen, you know, and feel overjoyed that at least our families were safe at long last, you know, because that was always a worry for us.
How did you keep in touch with home?
By letter. I used to write regularly to Mum and Dad. Yeah, they kept us informed, and told us about the raids that happened in Bournemouth here, you know, in fact my father was in the square when one of the bombs dropped down there and destroyed the something hotel on, I can't remember the name, but anyway he was thrown off his feet. He was just going through the square to his job at the Hampton Dorset bus station, and he was tossed off his feet, you know, but other than that they all survived, thank goodness.
Did you keep in touch with your brothers when they were serving in the RAF? Did you keep in touch with them as well?
No, I didn't. No. We used to. What did we do? We used to write to Mum and Dad, and they used to pass on the information because they replied to each other, you know. But I don't recall ever having to write or do anything to my own brothers at all.
And obviously the war in Japan finished in August 1945 as well.
Yeah.
You have more reason to celebrate that one anyway, because that was the conflict you were
in. Oh yeah, well, that once that had finished, of course our work was done there anyway, so it was time to get back home again.
Do you remember how the news was broken to you that day?
Oh, that was important, because I'd been in India for, I think, 3.5 years then. It seemed a long time, and I often used to look to the west when the sun set and hope that I'd be going that way very soon, you know. Yeah, there's quite mixed feelings, actually. You've got a job of work to do anyway. That occupies your mind as much as anything. But it's in times of rest that you suddenly start thinking about whether you'd like to be back home with the family and that.
I think it more so, especially when the war in Europe is finishing. Oh yes,
yeah. Oh yes, that was so. Yeah.
How did you feel at the time when you found out the nuclear bombs, the atomic bombs, had been dropped into capital cities?
Well, we had mixed feelings about that as well, because the destruction and the things that happened to the people that got caught in that atomic bomb, it really was something that you can't really accommodate, you know. Seemed altogether wrong, but at least it finished that business out there. That was the only good thing about it, you know. It's the only time that atomic bombs have been used on deliberately like that, so let's hope it's the only time that they ever will be used like that.
And in your time when you were posted overseas, when you first went away, did you ever get Lee home?
No. Not from overseas, I didn't. Used to get occasional stints home here whilst we were training, through the training period, a fortnight or so occasionally, you know. I came home to Bournemouth once on a fortnight's leave, and I had to report to the RAF Medical Centre at Merritt Park, down in the square there, and because I was itching on my arms and that and that. And they discovered I had scabies, so I spent the fortnight in that blasted hospital getting rid of scabies.
Did all your brothers come home from the war?
Yes, we all got back home from the war, yeah. None of us were injured in the war. Yeah, unscathed completely. Yeah, that was a good thing. But then the family broke up after the war. My eldest brother, for instance, he'd met a Liverpudlian Scouse girl whom he married, so he went to live at Liverpool. The next eldest brother had met a Canadian girl. He married her, brought her over to England, and had their first child here, but she was not happy here, so he went back with his family to Canada and has lived there ever since. And he got himself a job, an aircraft fitter's job in an internal airline, and finished up as the chief engineer there. So he did very well for himself out there. Came over and saw us about 5 or 6 times, I think, he came over here. And I kept promising him that I would get over to see him when I could, but it's only recently, in the last 3 years, I think, I've managed to get out there to see him. And it was last August. I only came back from there in August, in beginning of September, you know, this year. We had 3 weeks out there this year because the wife had decided that she wanted to go somewhere else for a change, you know. And then this offer came up from Malta, and I jumped at it, you know.
Were you ever superstitious during the war? Did you have any lucky charms? Or
not superstitious, but I prayed a lot, especially in the pranks, you know, when I knew that we were about to descend unorthodoxically, you know. Yeah, so I used to pray.
I was going to ask if you were religious.
Well, I don't think I can claim to be religious. I did, when I got back home, I was brought up in the Church of England faith, and it never impressed me greatly, because when you go into a Church of England church, it's dull and somber, and all the hymns are so, you know, banal, I always understood you had to you rejoiced in the worship of the Lord, you know, but they all seemed to be, it all seemed to be so drab and dim, and so I started looking around for a face which would match up to what I thought a Christian faith should be, and I tried several of them, and although initially they seemed to be all right, always I came up against something that didn't match up at all. You know, the last one was Methodist, I think it was, and I came out one day out of the Sunday meeting, and I heard a little group of people pulling other members to pieces, you know, standing there, tearing them to pieces, sort of thing. So I thought, oh, that can't be right. That's not Christian at all, you know. So I gave it up as a bad job, and I continued to feel the way I feel now about it. I don't go to church anymore. I don't do anything much in the way of religious work at all. But I feel that if I live my life as near as possible to the Christian beliefs and do nobody any harm, I consider that I'm a good Christian, and that is how I shall continue my days, you know.
Were your parents religious? Were your parents religious?
I wouldn't say so, no. No. They did make us go to Sunday school and things like that, but I wouldn't say they were over-religious at all, you know.
How did your demobilisation or your demobbing come about? How were you informed?
When we got back, first thing that happened after we got back was I was on 6 month demobilisation leave. So I scooted around. I went up to Liverpool to see my brother there, and I went down to Honiton in Devon, where my other brother was stationed. He was still in England at that time. I went down to see him. But other than that, I browsed about at home. I went over to the place I used to work and went in to see the gaffer, Mr. Calderwood, and that was where my job had been kept for me. I knew that. But I went in to see him, and when he saw me as an officer, he said, "I don't suppose you want to go back in the cream room now, Leslie?" I said, "No." I said, "No, I thought I'd look for something a bit better." He said, "Well, I've got the very thing for you." He said, "We've got a refrigeration company going now." He said, "If you'd like, you can go and train there." And I did my apprenticeship at the age of 27 under the senior. The senior engineer there, you know, Ginger Henstridge, whom I knew anyway because he was there before the war. Anyway, I did that and I became a qualified refrigeration engineer.
How does your demobbing take place in the area? Do you get given a suit as well?
Yeah. You go to the demobilisation centre and then you're taken into, I think it was a large tent. And there were all these outfits, and you just chose what you fancied, you know, a suit and an overcoat, whatever. You just chose it. And the reason I accepted demobilisation was because they wouldn't offer me a flying post. Flying was my love. I didn't want to sit behind a desk. That didn't suit me at all. So what happened a year after demob? I learnt about the reserve, so I re-enlisted in the RAF reserve and went up to Amble, number 14 RFS, and did my flying there. I did lectures at, I forget the name of the place, it's a bit further up the road from there. Anyway, we did lectures on a Wednesday night, and weekends we flew, and then every year in the summer we had a 15-day course up there at Hamble, and in addition to getting my flying back, I was getting paid my rate of pay for my rank and trade. So that was a bonus, the money. I didn't think we'd get paid for it, you know. I thought it was a voluntary thing. But that only lasted 5 years because, conscription was in force then.
National service.
Yeah, national service, and they had to serve, they automatically had to serve in the VR for a period after the service, you know.
VR?
Yes, in the volunteer reserve, whichever unit they were in, Army, Navy, or Air Force. So, of course, within 5 years, they had enough press gang people to run the VR and didn't have to pay them, like, you know. So the VR as such was disbanded, and we received pleasant letters from the ministry, the MOD, thanking us for our faithful service over the years, but would we please now stand down, you know.
What planes were you taught to fly in?
Now, we were, navigators and radio operators were in Anson 21s, pilots were in Chipmunks, Swordfish. Now, bearing in mind that the front line, we were supposed to be the reserve front line air force. The front line air force were flying all jet aircraft, so everything we did would have had to been done in a third, maybe a quarter of the time that we were doing it in the Anson and the other thing. So it was a bit of a farce anyway, you know. But I got my flying in, that was the important thing, and as I say, the bonus was the money, and we got petrol coupons. It was still in ration, you know, there. And there were six of us from Bournemouth who went up to Hamble, all had cars, and so we used one car, only one car at the weekend, so that all of us got the petrol coupons, and then we took it in turns to do the trip, you know, six different cars, six weekends, and we all got petrol coupons because we'd attended there, you know, but we only used one car. So
and as you say, it was volunteer.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So you didn't get paid to do this.
Yes.
Oh, you did get paid.
Oh yes, we got paid. Our rate of pay for rank and trade, we got paid. Yeah.
I was going to ask, how did the war affect? Did you ever have any problems adjusting to a normal way of life after
yes.
the war?
Yes. To start with, I was used to being called sir as an officer. That was the one thing that didn't go down too well, you know. I became a non-entity again, as it were. And I got quite used and pleased to that, with that business of being an officer, being addressed as sir, you know, being saluted by the junior ranks and so on and so forth. Surprising, actually. No, I wasn't big-headed about it, but it was nice. It was comfortable. I'd grown up in a deprived family. I mean, you can't say we were terribly, terribly poor family. There was no doubt about that. I'd grown up to accept that I was lesser, not better than anybody else. You know, I was a lesser person because of our position in life there. And all of a sudden, I'm an officer, you know, and I'm a person who's revered and looked up to by other people. It made quite an acceptable change to me.
You were a flight lieutenant.
I finished up as a flight lieutenant, yes.
You recall your number?
Yes, I do. 1194828 as an airman, 201022 as an officer.
And what was your date of birth?
14/10/21.
Anything else you'd like to say?
I think that's about it. That's covered pretty well everything, you know.
Yeah, I was just asking you if there was ever any bullying.
No, definitely not. You absolutely depended on each other for life when you became a crew. Everybody was as important as the other. there was no choice between each of it. If you didn't work together, then you could look to losing your life quite easily if you didn't work together. And this is how it was, this is how it worked. And in any case, you're in a very confined space in an aircraft, really. So you get to sort of grow on each other. But I, with my crew, my pilot in particular, we became like brothers, absolutely. And I stayed in touch with him for some time after the war, and then for reasons which I can't remember, we lost contact. But when I retired, I scouted around, and finally, after about, it was 5 or 6 years before, I finally got back in touch with him. And we've been in contact ever since, up until last June, when he unfortunately died due to a brain tumour.
Because, like you were saying, when they chose the air crew, you were more or less forced upon each other.
Yeah.
Like, I'll take a pilot.
This is right, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, you picked your own crew anyway. You weren't told who you had. You were just told to select your crew. And that's what we did.
But I know with the Air Force, you weren't allowed to mix. Say if you were an officer,